Okay, so everybody's taken the test now, and we can start the last quarter of the semester. You remember we started it with the previous lecture talking about carbonyl compounds as sort of a survey of the kind of reactions they have, and we'll continue that survey now with the first couple slides and then go on to stuff in chapter 16 in a little more detail. We mentioned last time the patterns of reaction for carboxylic acids, that you can have addition to the carbon-oxygen double bond of an acid in the nucleophile, that you can get substitution where you replace the OH by OR, breaking the carbon-oxygen bond, the carbonyl-oxygen bond, or you can do a substitution at the oxygen there, breaking the oxygen to R group bond, or oxygen to H. So all those are possible, and most of them you can figure out. Okay. And it's also possible, as in other carbonyl compounds that we mentioned last time, to do reactions at the alpha carbon, where that H can be removed and replaced with something else. Okay, now one particular reaction is very popular, which is Fischer esterification, which is the way to convert a carboxylic acid into an ester, and it's discovered, as you can see, by Emil Fischer. So it's substitution, the Fischer esterification. There are other esters where you break the OH bond, but here we're breaking the carbon-oxygen bond and replacing the O together with the R group. And the Fischer esterification that does that reaction is acid catalyzed. So let's think a little bit about the mechanism that could be involved, just to show that these are things that you really know well, even if we haven't talked about them in detail. So a proton is going to come on and to add. And it starts with addition to the carbon-oxygen double bond. So the proton comes on and protonates the carbonyl oxygen. Now, there are two oxygens there. Both of them have lone pairs. Why does it protonate the top oxygen rather than the bottom oxygen? Can anybody see an advantage as to which oxygen you might protonate? Don? Right, there's going to be resonance stabilization. Because in this symmetrical structure, obviously, we could draw the double bond on the bottom and put the positive charge down there. Another way of thinking of it is that unshared pair in the starting acid, before we put the top proton on, that unshared pair down there has already been stabilized by mixing with the pi star LUMO of the carbonyl. So it's not that unshared pair is not such a high HOMO. The other one is a higher HOMO, the one on the oxygen on the top, which doesn't overlap with the pi star. And furthermore, after the thing has been protonated on top, then that unshared pair on the bottom is still more stabilized. Why is it more stabilized after you protonated it on the top? I said that it was stabilized before you protonated it on the top, because it overlapped with pi star. Why should it be specially stabilized now?
Positive charge.
Right, so the positive charge on the top now will lower the LUMO even more, so you get special stabilization. And another way of saying the same thing is that you have resonance stabilization, but this is the source of resonance stabilization. This unusually low LUMO. Okay, so we protonated on top. Also, we could draw the resonance structure that has positive charge on the carbon. And that makes it easy to see what will happen with an alcohol. Okay, so the unshared pair of alcohol comes in and forms a bond, and you get this tetrahedral carbon intermediate. Notice originally the carbon was trigonal planar, attached to only three things. Now the intermediate in this substitution that we're going to do is tetrahedral. So it's a tetrahedral intermediate because the mechanism is not like the mechanism of an SN2 substitution reaction, where the nucleophile comes in and the leaving group leaves simultaneously. This one forms an intermediate. Okay, and in fact, it's very analogous to the intermediate we had for substitution, nucleophilic substitution in the aromatic ring, in the Sanger's reagent, where remember the amine comes in and forms this bond of tetrahedral carbon, which takes this out of the pi system. Remember you have this, and then the fluoride leaves. Here we have the same kind of thing, where it goes in and takes the carbon out of the pi system, makes a tetrahedral intermediate. Of course, the next stage is to lose the proton. And then you put a proton back on again. You could have put the proton back on the OR. The OR could have left. The H plus on top could have left, and you'd go right back where you started from. But it's equally easy to protonate the other oxygen, right? And or indeed the oxygen on the top, which is equivalent to this one. So you can lose the OH instead of the OR. And that accomplishes the substitution of carbon, and all you have to do now, of course, is to lose the proton, and you've done Fischer esterification. And the reaction is pretty near thermoneutral, right? You can shift, how would you shift the equilibrium one way or the other? Because you notice the bond you made and the bond you broke. You broke an OH bond, broke a CO bond to OH, you make a CO bond to OR. They're almost exactly the same. How can you make the reaction go in the direction desired?
If you took out the bonds that had the principle pushed into the right?
If you could take the products out, for example, if you could perhaps distill the product out, the ester, you could, the ester is more volatile, depending on what R is more volatile than the acid, because the acid forms a hydrogen bonded dimer, so it doesn't out as easily typically. But often the alcohol would be even more volatile, so when you start your distillation, you're going to remove the alcohol, which isn't such a great idea. Put a lot of the alcohol in, just use the law of mass action to shift it one way, or put a lot of water in and shift it back the other way. Although, as we'll see when we talk about carboxylic acids in section 20, that using base is a much better way to drive the equilibrium if you want to take the ester apart. And the reason is, in that case, you do remove the acid, make it much more stable by reacting with the base and taking the proton off. But we'll get to that later on. Okay, this is just to show you a typical kind of reaction that happens in these four or five chapters we're doing about carbonyl groups, and that it's all concepts that are quite familiar to you. So now I'm going to spend just a little time leafing through pages of the book on these chapters about things that we've talked about adding to carbonyl, we've talked about acetal formation and hemiacetal formation with acid catalysis. In that context, we talked briefly about protecting groups, and then imines and enamines are a small extension of this. So all these are things we've talked before, and rather than boring you by going through it in great detail, I'm just going to leap through the book and point out as we go along several things that are a little new or different. Okay, so the first section is the 16.6 about reversible additions to carbonyl compounds. So it talks about you can do addition to alkenes, you can also do additions to carbonyls. Carbonyls are easier because they're easier to protonate, so you can do acid-catalyzed things. They're also easier to attack by bases. Remember, nucleophiles don't attack the alkenes really as well. But both mechanisms are possible for carbonyl groups. And then There are several pages here of going through this in sort of excruciating detail of drawing the curved arrows and so on. And all these are things we've done before. So I don't think we need to be talking about this thing being resonance stabilized. We've talked about why we protonate carbon dioxide so easily. And so here's comparing hydrating an alkene with hydrating a carbonyl. And it's easy to do with a carbonyl because it's so easy to protonate. But here's the difference, right, between an alkene and a carbonyl. That if you try to do it with a nucleophile attacking first, that doesn't happen easily, at least not with hydroxide on a carbon double bond. But it happens easily on a carbon oxygen double bond. So you can do that. Now, then this section 16.7 is about the equilibrium constant for these adding water to the carbonyl group, either by the acid or the base catalysis mechanism. You don't care. An equilibrium is an equilibrium. Okay? But it's interesting how different these equilibrium constants are. Notice that in adding to formaldehyde with two H's on the carbonyl group, the equilibrium constant is 2,000. So 2,000 times as much of this as of this. Okay? When you substitute one of the hydrogens with a methyl group, the equilibrium constant is 1. So you have equal amounts of the hydrate and the aldehyde. If you substitute both of them by methyl, then you get 2 times 10 to the minus 3, only 1/500 as much of the diol as of the carbonyl. Now, it goes through explaining this, but I bet you can help me out and understand it without going through the explanation here. What factors would make... So at the top, this is relatively unstable compared to this. At the bottom, this is relatively stable compared to this. Pardon me, I'm backwards. This is comparatively... this is comparatively stable related compared to that. So it goes this way. Here, this one's more stable than this. It goes that way. Okay. Now, why? Can anybody think of a reason? Matt, what do you think? How would the change of replacing hydrogen by methyl tend to make you go this direction from the left? Okay, you could have hyperconjugation of the CH bonds with pi star, right? But there's certainly that factor, right? But that may not be the main factor. We talked about this before in talking about the stability of substituted alkenes. What is it? Can you remember anything besides the hyperconjugation that would favor having a methyl group on the carbon? Happy? Can't hear. Right. Right. Remember, carbon-carbon bonds really profit from being sp squared as opposed to sp cubed. So here is sp on the left is sp squared. Here is sp cubed. You profit on the left by putting methyl groups on to make carbon-carbon bonds with those sp squared. So that's a factor. That favors going to the left here. There's another, even probably simpler factor than hyperconjugation and sigma bond strength. Henry? Yes, steric hindrance. This is putting four things on the carbon makes it more crowded. The angle between CCC gets smaller when it's a tetrahedral angle rather than a trigonal 120 degree angle. So these move closer together, and you're trying to crowd another group in next to these groups which are much bigger than this. So you already understand the factors that are involved in this. We don't need to dwell on it. They go through all this stuff about. Incidentally, here it's slightly confusing, or at least it bears a little pointing out when you hear me talk about this. It looks as though you're comparing things here with things here. But really, what you're comparing in any case is this versus this and factors that change that, which we just discussed. Right? But you can't, it's not meaningful to compare, say, the heat of formation of this with the heat of formation of, I turned two pages. It's not meaningful to compare the heat of formation of this and the heat of formation of this, because you have different atoms, completely different bonds, right? What you're always comparing is things that are isomers to do proper energy comparison. So here you have this plus H2O, which is an isomer of this. And these factors we just discussed are something that favor one over the other. Here are kindreds, carbon-carbon bond strength, hyperconjugation. Okay, here it talks about steric destabilization and substitution by metals, making it better. And here are an example of a number of aldehydes that have other equilibrium constants. And one thing that I don't know that one could easily have anticipated is that when you have electronegative groups on the carbon here, like trifluoro methyl group as opposed to a methyl group. Remember what the equilibrium constant is when that's a methyl group rather than a trifluoro methyl? I mean, I've been going through this fast and you'll have an easier time. Mike? It's one. Remember, if they're both hydrogens, it's 1,000 in one direction. If they're both methyls, it's 1,000 in the other direction. But if it's one methyl and one hydrogen, the equilibrium constant is one. But you see that putting those electronegative groups on there really boosts the equilibrium constant. It's 30,000 now. So exactly why that is, I'm not completely confident of. But there's an explanation here in terms of making this and this negative charge as far as possible, and that negative charge, partial negative charges. That certainly is a factor, and that's the whole thing, I don't know. But anyhow, that's something that's new in here. Otherwise, it's all stuff we've talked about. The next section here is adding other nucleophiles besides oxygen. This is hydroxide nucleophile that's added, that we've been talking about back here. But there are others that can add. One really interesting one is cyanide, which can add to give this compound called cyanohydrin. So CN minus is an X. Right? Protonate the oxygen, and instead of OHOH, you have CNOH. One reason that's interesting is that CN is a close relative of COOH, and it's more or less easily converted into it. And if you made that into COOH instead of CN, then you would have a hydroxy acid, which is a compound of more importance than the cyanohydrin itself. And if you started with a CN double bond, what would the compound be if you did that? If you started, instead of a CO double bond, start with a CN double bond, an imine, right? Does the same kind of reaction, doesn't surprise you. Put CN on with NH2 here now. Now you convert that into a carboxylic acid. Can you see why that might have been of interest synthetically when it was discovered around 1816? Yeah. Those are the amino acids of nature. So it's possible artificially to make amino acids by that kind of reaction. Okay. Of course, you wonder, where does the CN double bond come in? And that we'll see just here. Okay. So there's another thing you can add there that's also important. And now, acetal formation. We've talked about this twice already, so we don't have to do that anymore, except to note there are a few specific examples here. In particular, ones where the OH and the aldehyde are in the same molecule, so one can form a cyclic hemiacetal. Or in this, or in other cases here, and you see where the equilibrium constant lies, but I don't think that's particularly relevant, except in the case of aldehyde alcohols, that have lots of alcohols on them, because these are sugars. And sugars usually exist, not in this open form, but in the form of a hemiacetal, where the OH, either the one on the bottom or the next one, is added to this one. Yeah. That big line means that they wanted to use a Fischer projection, right? And they wanted to draw all these to denote the configuration of the sugar as Fischer did. Fischer being the guy who not only did Fischer esterification, but also figured out what all the isomers of sugar were. And we talked about him when we talked about stereochemistry last semester and the idea of Fischer projections, right? Now, if you use that way, remember that's a very unnatural way. It's not at all, doesn't look at all like the molecule, because it suggests that all the, you know, all the bonds from each carbon go back in, are bent and go back in. So it's not at all right. And it becomes especially problematic when you have to get this OH to react with that aldehyde, right? So what you do is put in a real long bond if you want to draw a Fischer. So the Fischer projection is good for showing the stereochemistry, but it's not at all good for showing the shape of the molecule. But they say here something to watch out with the convention at work. The convention is Fischer projection, right? And if you do Fischer projection, you have to draw this long bond so you have to say, that's the right place. Okay. Now this is all about protonating on Neo and who's coming on. Well, just as we talked about. I mean, it's okay to. I mean, it's a good idea to read through this and do it again and again. It's probably better to do it on your own without help from the book. If you need help, it's there to show how hemiacetals and acetals form. And one thing you find out very soon in the formation of hemiacetals and acetals is you can't get there from here in the case of using base rather than acid. Because remember, first you add and get the OR and an OH group, and then you have to replace that OH by another OR to get two ORs on the same carbon. That's a ketone acetal, right? The second one, you have to replace OH. Right? And for that, you can't do that easily with base, because OH minus is such a crummy leaving group. So if you try to do it with base, you can add the OR minus and get this and protonate it and get a hemiacetal. But you can't replace the OH minus and go to a full acetal. So that just seems like a sort of trivial limitation in the fact instead. But it actually is intrinsic to one of the main utilities of acetal, which is you can't go to the acetal with base, but you can't come back either. You can't replace OR minus either without acid. Right? And the important thing about that is if you take a carbonyl, which would react readily with many basic sort of things, nucleophiles that would attack the carbonyl. If you convert it into a ketal, get rid of the CO double bond, then you can't react with those basic reagents. Right? So that, remember, we actually mentioned this before. Do you remember what concept that's leading up to? So you can make it so a carbonyl group in a compound won't react with something. You want something else in the molecule to react with that. Victor? The protecting group, which is our next subject here. Because then, but the important thing is you want to be able to get the carbonyl back. How do you do it? When you have an acetal and you've done something with your nucleophile elsewhere in the molecule, now you want your carbonyl back again. Because it's safe, the coast is clear. How do you get it back? Done?
Use acid.
Acid can go all the way back and forth, the base can't. So this inability to do this, either in this direction or this direction, is really important for the concept of protective groups. Okay, this brings us to protective groups and synthesis. So here's an example. In this case, they protect when they, turns out I don't think anybody would ever do this. I don't think you need to do this protection. Because the idea was here there are two double bonds, a carbon-carbon double bond and a carbon-oxygen double bond. What they want to do is hydrogenate so as to remove the carbon-carbon double bond but not touch the carbon-oxygen double bond. Okay? So what's done here is to protect the carbon-oxygen double bond, make a ketal, then do the hydrogenation to remove the carbon-carbon, and then use acid to take that back off, and you're where you want to be. But in fact, I don't think anyone would ever do this, because it's fairly easy when both double bonds are present to choose a reagent that will react with the carbon-carbon and not the carbon-oxygen double bond. So this is just an illustration, not something you'd actually do, but this talks about what we just did about protecting. And here's a very common reagent used to form ketals. The idea in this case is not to protect the carbonyl. The idea is to protect the alcohol. That's something that Professor Ziegler, synthetic chemist in this department who taught synthesis for many years, often points out. When you put a when you make a protecting group, you're not only protecting the carbonyl, you're also protecting the alcohol. It's in an ether too, so you don't have the OH of the alcohol that might react with the base. Right? So two things get protected at once, and often the mind works in such a way that you focus on one thing and the other one is just a reagent. But in this case, you use a ketal, here's the ketal, two ORs attached to the common carbon. But the goal was to protect the R, protect the alcohol, not to protect this. So this compound gets protonated, the alcohol adds there, easy to see that. Loses a proton and you've got a ketal. Okay? And now you can do something out on this R group that you wanted to do that requires a strong base that would have reacted with the H on ROH if it still existed, but it doesn't. This thing is inert to bases. So you do a reaction, whatever you want, with the OR protected and then treat it with acid and you're back, you get the alcohol back. So the interesting thing is what we've been talking about is protecting carbonyl, but this actually is protecting the R. Now, in this one, notice that we did the deprotecting with acid. Suppose that the thing you were going to do with the alcohol required using an acid, but you still needed to protect the alcohol. So wouldn't it be neat if you had protecting groups that had different ways of deprotecting them, different reagents, so you could decide what it's going to be inert to while you're doing your reactions, and then use some different reagent rather than just acid to take it apart. And that's the last example here that they've been talking about protecting groups, which is a very common reagent. Here it's obvious that you're protecting an alcohol, there's no carbonyl in question. But you react it with this silyl chloride. Now silicon, of course, is below carbon in the periodic table. It has vacant valence shell orbitals, d orbitals. It's possible for a nucleophile to attack to have its electron stabilized by the silicon to do an association and then lose a group. So you do a nucleophilic substitution on silicon by first having the oxygen attack the silicon, lose the proton from the OH, the OSI as it is now, and then lose fluoride. So you put the silicon on in place of hydrogen. Okay, so this is a kind of ether, and it's pretty stable. The silicon bond with oxygen is pretty strong. So that can survive a lot of fiddling around. So you can do other things in the molecule. You could probably do aromatic substitution on this, for example, which would require an acid, you know, acidic electrophilic aromatic substitution. Okay. And but acid doesn't take this off as well. What takes it off is fluoride, F minus. Right? And the reason is that fluoride forms a fabulously strong bond with silicon. So fluoride attacks and then the OR leaves. And you can recover this, it says, at 100% yield, and 100% yield of the agent that was taken off. Okay, so that's another example of a... I mean, it seems slightly out of place in this chapter because it has nothing to do with carbonyls, but we've been talking, he was talking about protecting groups of carbonyls, and it's interesting, as I just said, to see that protecting one reagent also is protecting the other one. And this is another, in many cases, more effective way to protect that other reagent with the alcohol. Okay. Then, here's to the last topic here, imines and enamines. And this is sort of more of the same as well. Here we have the carbonyl and they've got an acid catalyzed. They've got an acid catalyzed, so it's an ammonium ion. But of course, the carbonyl, some of the time, will take the proton away from here, so you have the protonated carbonyl and the amine. Now, you're not surprised what happens next. If I cover it, what will happen next? If you have the amine there and this protonated carbonyl.
Well, the amine will attack the
carbon. Right, the amine will attack the carbon. So you get this. What will happen next? I just want to show you that you really know this. What would happen in this kind of thing typically? Yeah.
The hydrogen
fall. Yeah, we lose the proton. So we've got this, and this is called, as you see, a carbonyl amine. Carbonyl amine. Right? What's it analogous to that we've just been talking about if you had an O instead of an N there? You don't have to look far, yeah. Yeah, it's an OH, so it's a hemiacetal, or the analog would be a hydrate, you know. But anyhow, so carbonyl amine, same deal. Okay. And then, of course, the carbonyl amine can fall apart, losing not the nitrogen, you go back to the starting material, but losing the OH. And then you have a CN double bond. Right? Imine, actually, it's an imine cation because it still has a proton. What do you think happens next? Pardon me? Yeah, proton falls off, so then you have an imine. Okay, so we're there now, someplace here. Here we've got an imine, proton fell off. Okay, now, what's certain, in the olden days, when there wasn't spectroscopy to identify things in lab, one of the common things to do was to convert. So I say you had a carbonyl compound. It's a liquid. It's a colorless. And, you know, what the heck is it? You can do an elemental analysis. But the standard way of identifying things, if you took a course that people took then called qualitative organic analysis to find out what the stuff was to convert it into a crystalline compound. Right, in a reaction that was very reliable and gave good yields, and then measure the melting point of that and compare it with authentic samples. So you had a big table of all these particular derivatives made with a particular reagent of different, say, aldehydes or different ketones, and then you went through and found out what your melting point was. Fortunately, people aren't subjected to that much anymore. But in those days, these reagents, especially this one, were particularly popular because they gave something that was nicely crystalline, right? So you can purify it very easily to get a good melting point. And it had a very high equilibrium constant for forming this thing from the starting carbonyl. Right? So that was very important. That what in principle you could, these things go back and forth. You remove the oxygen of the carbonyl, replace it with the N double bond. You can go exactly reverse the reaction and go back the other way. You could shift it by shifting concentrations. But for this kind of purpose, you'd like to add just a little bit of this reagent and have it convert all to this, and then crystallize it and find out what the compound was, this derivative. And the thing that helped that out, notice that these things that are involved here, all these ones down at the bottom, have something in common. All of these things, all of the things from here on down were used for this purpose of making crystalline derivatives. What do these at the bottom all have in common that might influence the equilibrium constant? Can anybody see how they're different? Because regular images tend not to be so stable. The equilibrium constant is fairly delicately balanced between the CO double bond and the CN double bond. But these have very favorable equilibrium constants for forming the derivative. What do they have in common? Victor? Yeah, it's resonance stabilization, but what made it possible was these things like here's the purest example, have unshared pairs on atoms next to one another. So those filled orbitals mix with one another, go up more than they go down. So that's a factor that makes the starting material relatively unstable to have two hetero atoms in a row. But in the product, it's great. This unshared pair is in the sigma system, the one on the nitrogen. And now this double bond has become, this unshared pair is adjacent to the double bond. It's become allylic. So the unshared pair here on the oxygen, which formerly was destabilized by overlapping with an unshared pair next door, now is next to the vacant orbital here, the pi star orbital. So it was bad in the starting material and good in the product. So these things have fantastically good equilibrium constants to get these derivatives, but you don't make them very much nowadays. Okay, more about imines. And then it's possible to dehydrate, to lose the other bond. Let me see where we're going here. These are all the same here. Okay. It's possible if you have, especially if you have two R groups on the nitrogen, so you can't do the normal thing, which is to lose a proton when you make this cation. You can lose this proton, right? And now you have a thing called an ene amine. Right? And those things give useful property to carbon. This, because you can imagine this pair of electrons coming in to reform the double bond, and this pair of electrons then coming out to do something else. Okay? So that makes this carbon a little bit like a carbon anion. It has a high HOMO on it. You can think of the high HOMO being the occupied allylic orbital here, which in the symmetrical case, if that were carbon, remember, has a node in the middle. Big coefficient here, big coefficient here. So it's a very high, unusually high HOMO, big on carbon. So it's like a carbon anion. It can be used to do things like SN2 reactions and so on. Okay, so enamines are relevant for that purpose. And let's see if there's anything else. This is all more of the same. Okay, now it goes on to, so we've done as much as we're going to do here, and you can obviously review that in the book. It was a little silly for me to spend the time to animate it here. So I didn't. Are there any questions about that stuff? It's all stuff we've done before, really, but a little bit elaborated. Now, the next section have to do with oxidation reduction, and we've mentioned oxidation and reduction before, but we never really defined what we meant by oxidation reduction. One thing that's clear that we've talked about before is electron transfer. When you transfer an electron to something, it acquires a negative charge and is said to be reduced in its oxidation level, went from zero to minus, say. And if you take an electron away, it goes zero to plus, and it's said to be an oxidation. Okay, so that's fairly clearly defined if you have an electron transfer. Let's look at a few examples where there really is electron transfer. And then we're going to talk about oxidation reduction as a more generalized concept. Remember what it first meant? When were the words oxidation and reduction first applied to chemistry? Yeah?
When you have more bonds to oxygen.
No, it was long before bonds were done.
Yeah.
Lavoisier, remember he talked about oxidation? Reacting with oxide and when things became acid when they were oxidized. And reduction was an even more ancient concept. Oxidation couldn't have come before Lavoisier. You know why nobody could have used the term before Lavoisier? Because the name oxygen was invented by Lavoisier. But reduction was a very old thing because it was known that you could take metals and they would become calcium, or whatever you call them, they would become rust. But then you could lead them back again. Duco ducere is to lead, right? Re-lead. So you lead these things back to the original metal. That was reduced. Okay, so that was the original term. But then once electrons became popular at the turn of the century and after that, then the idea of electron transfer became important. But you'll see that there's a more general concept of oxidation reduction that we're going to get to. But first, about electron transfer. Suppose you have solid magnesium and react it with methyl bromide or some other alkyl. This is called a reduction. Okay. Now, let's see why. Let's talk about what is it that makes methyl bromide reactive with respect to electrons. If you're going to do an electron transfer, what, say, vacant orbital is there that you could put an electron in? Is there an unusually low vacant orbital?
Sigma star,
right, of CdR. And magnesium metal, of course, has high electrons. I think we've mentioned this in passing before. Okay, so you can get an electron transfer. Now the electron has been put in sigma star. What effect will that have? Yeah? So the bond will break. Okay, it'll become a methyl radical and a bromine anion. Okay, now the methyl radical can form a bond with magnesium. In fact, it can pull a magnesium atom out. So now you have methyl magnesium bromide. Did you say you had not done this in lab? Well, it used to be a fairly common thing to do. You know, this is called a Grignard reagent. So again, like, remember, the enamine is popular in synthetic chemistry because it's a little bit like a carbon anion. This is also a little bit like a carbon anion, the Grignard reagent, because that those electrons are so high in energy. And we talked about methyl lithium, an analog of this, reacting with carbonyl already last semester. And this is the subject of 1613 is stuff about in 1612 is organometallic reagents, and 1613 is their addition to carbonyl groups. So they talk here about such reagents. And this won the Nobel Prize in 1912. That was very early. The first Nobel Prize was 1901 and went to Van 't Hoff. 1912, Victor Grignard from France got the prize for this because it was so useful, and it was easy to make and so useful to have carbon anions that add the carbonyl groups. Now, suppose instead of methyl bromide or some other alkyl halide, you use the carbonyl compound. Now, what can you guess what's going to happen here if you react this with magnesium? Avi, please.
That it has to be high star.
Right, high star is a low LUMO. So we can do exactly the same trick, reduction, take an electron transfer into pi star, and we've got this. In fact, it does it with two acetones. So we got two of these together with the magnesium dication. So whereas in the Grignard reagent you had just one, here you have of these, now you have two. Now, those are both anions, both attracted form ionic bonds with the magnesium. You see what would happen next? Sagar, what do you say? Yeah, two radicals can react with one another. They're held right together by the magnesium next to one another. So you can get this bond, right? Which resulted from the original electron transfers. If you then hydrolyze it with water to change the alkoxides back into alcohols, you get this compound, which is called pinacol. Interesting, the name pinacol is not because it's pina coladas or made from pine oil or anything like that. It's that there's a geometric solid shape called a pinacoid, and its crystals have that shape. But anyhow, this is called the pinacol reduction, and it actually involves an electron transfer, an obvious reduction. Just for you to think about, you can do this in your room. Think about how when you treat pinacol with proton, it gives pinacolone a ketone. See if you figure out the mechanism of that. So T-butyl methyl ketone has the common name pinacolone. Okay, now, so that was oxidation reduction that everyone would agree is such a thing, an electron transfer. But there's another kind of oxidation reduction, which is just bookkeeping. It doesn't have anything to do with reality, really. But it's still very useful, and that's what I want to illustrate here. Okay, and the idea is to assign oxidation states to atoms within molecules. Now, this is arbitrary. It's a little bit like Prelog talking to Robinson. He said it's just a convention. You use it or you don't. Okay, so you arbitrarily take bonds that are in shared electrons that are in shared pair bonds and not obviously assignable to either of the atoms, and you assign them to the more electronegative element, okay, as if they were ionic bonds. If the two atoms are the same, you put one electron each way, right? But even if they're the same, but obviously unsymmetrical, because one is sp2 and the other is sp3 or something like that, you might think that you take that into account, but you don't. It's just a convention. You look at the two atoms, if they're the same electronegativity, if the two atoms are identical, you put one each way. If they're different electronegativity, then you put them both for the more electronegative thing and assign an oxidation state. And in fact, we already talked about this, or more properly, Professor Siegel talked about when he went through these and assigned oxidation levels to carbon atoms. This is not the oxidation level of the molecule. It's the oxidation level of the carbon atom within a molecule. So here, CO2, the carbon forms four bonds to oxygen, two double bonds to oxygen. All the electrons are assigned to oxygen, which means carbon has lost its four valence electrons, so plus four. Here, carbon forms three bonds to oxygen, a double to one oxygen and a single bond to the other. That means it would be plus, it would lose three electrons, plus three, but it has a bond to hydrogen, which gives its electron in this scheme, even though the bond is, of course, essentially covalent. In this scheme, it gives that electron to carbon. So instead of plus three, it's plus two. Right? Here it's neutral because there are two bonds to oxygen, two bonds to hydrogen, so they cancel. Here it's minus two, and here minus four with the four oxygen. It's quite obvious. But this is, of course, very arbitrary. Bonds don't have anything like this ionic character. Now, so here's oxidation reduction as bookkeeping. Let's just go through these two compounds. Suppose we want to convert one to the other and see whether we're changing the oxidation level of any atoms. Okay, so let's just practice. How about here? What's the oxidation level of this carbon? Okay. How did you get that? Three hydrogens, each giving an electron to the carbon, and one carbon-carbon bond, which doesn't count. Okay, so that's minus 3. How about this carbon? Shirley? Zero. It's all its bonds are to carbon. How about this bond, this carbon? Shirley? Still can't hear. Yeah, it loses 2 to the oxygen. The other 2 are to carbon. They don't do anything. So plus 2. How about this one? Just like these. Okay, now let's look at the product, the carbons in the product. Of course, this one is obvious. It's the same as it was in the starting material. That's the same as it was in the starting material. That one, though, is now 0, right? It gets an electron from hydrogen. It gives an electron to oxygen. The other's in the carbon. So that one's 0. Now the last one is minus 3. So there's one carbon that changed its oxidation level. Right? It was plus 2 at the beginning. It was relatively oxidized, and it's relatively reduced at the end. Okay? So this is a reduction. Now, why do you do this, bookkeeping? Who cares? It's because it helps with reagent selection. You want to know what reagent might be able to do this, right? And it's clear that what you're going to need is a reducing agent. So next time we'll continue with this and talk about how we can classify reagents as oxidizing or reducing agents so we know which kind might be able to do this.